Thanks, Greg. Yes, we're backstage with Bramwell Tovey. Welcome back to Philadelphia.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you here. And this is such an engaging program. All of these pieces are interesting, not just for the stories they tell, but for their backstories. Could you talk a little bit about the shape of this program?
Well, it's an unusual program. Two English pieces followed by an Italian-American classic, A Mile and the Night Visitors. But Crown Imperial is really, it's William Walton's answer to Edward Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance marches. He wrote several great sort of Elgarian marches. One of them is in the middle of Belshazzar's Feast, the great choral work. Another one is Auburn Scepter, which was done for the present Queen's coronation in 1953. But this was the first one, Crown Imperial, and it so assumes the Elgarian mantle, it's uncanny.
What do you mean by Elgarian?
When we use the word Elgarian in English, we usually mean something that has been heavily influenced by or has qualities of Edward Elgar. There's a sweeping majesty. Elgar used to write this work nobilmente in his scores. Nobody else I've ever seen has ever used that word. And basically, it just means in a noble manner. And that nobilmente feeling is very definitely there in the central section of the march because it just introduces this stately tune, which you could imagine people dancing or waltzing, as it were, through the House of Lords in ermine and gorgeous velvet capes and so on and so forth. It's got that sort of regal feel to it.
I noticed all the pieces on this program were written within about 15 years of each other. The next piece we heard, The Briton, The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, which could be called the Any Person's Guide to the Orchestra, actually.
Well, it could. In fact, it's got another name as well, which is Variations on a Theme of Henry Purcell. It was written for a film about the orchestra, a television film, and based on a theme of Purcell from some 200-odd years before. And every department of the orchestra, from the flutes right down to the double basses, gets their go at the tune, and their variation of the tune. And at the end, everything is sewn together in one glorious, great big fugue. The great thing about it is that it introduces young people, or people of any age, to a symphony orchestra. Now, the narration, the original narration, is a little bit, it grates a little on modern ears. It's not like the narration to Peter and the Wolf, which is eternal. But the reason I chose to do it like that was that it seemed to me that there were moments when one could introduce certain departments and just really bring the audience, especially the younger members of the audience, a little bit closer. So that's where all that came from.
Well, that's great. We're about to hear, after intermission, A Mile and the Night Visitors, which is a classic. The first opera written for TV, I understand.
Yes, and it became an instant hit. And it was performed on TV. It was at NBC, I think, for over 14, 15 years. There's a whole generation seems to have grown up with A Mile and the Night Visitors. I remember watching it on the BBC, I think, in the middle of the 60s. And that was the only time that I saw it growing up. But I remember hearing soundtracks or bits on the radio. I think for a lot of people, it's very evocative. As soon as it strikes up, people know where they were when they first heard it. And of course, the story is also amazing. It starts off just as a story about a mum and her child. They're in very straitened circumstances. He's unable to get around very easily. She's poor. They've lost all their cattle. They have no money. They're having to go begging. And suddenly the three kings knock at their door. And it's just an amazing story. So simple, and yet it's got this incredible longevity, this incredible history and backstory of performances.
Well, it has so many elements. It has the mother fighting with her son and not believing him when he's describing the sights he's seeing outside the window. And it's funny. And then there's this mystique when the three visitors come and prove him right, that there was somebody.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting looking outside the door. I watched it on TV when I was growing up as a young child, and I just loved it. And I found as I grew, I started relating to it on different levels because you can relate to it as the child, you can relate to it as a parent. There's a great community scene.
You can relate to it as a rich person and as a poor person because it addresses issues of privilege and issues of poverty, not in a confrontational way, but in just a very gentle way. And it's this gentleness that gives it its power. It's very powerful.
And the music is so expressive of all of the goings-on in the story.
Absolutely. At the beginning, we hear the oboes playing, and we've got this picture of a mall playing the oboe and his mother trying to drag him to bed, but he's enjoying playing the oboe too much. And then it comes back at the end again, the thrill when he's allowed to go and visit the baby Jesus and although Jesus is never actually mentioned by name, just this idea that a king has been born and is a babe but will soon be walking among us. It's a very unique way of addressing the story of the Nativity because it barely addresses it, but we meet the three kings who are peripheral to the story. They're characters, and we see those human beings. I mean, one of them is a bit deaf. It's probably a joke that a composer couldn't really make these days, but it's part of the story here. Then it's stipulated that one of the kings is black and that they have this incredible relationship between the three of them. They almost they take words out of each other's mouths and they know each other's habits. And whereas to us reading the Bible or hearing the biblical story of the Nativity, we picture three kings, and I don't know quite what we imagine. I think for years I have always imagined King George VI and a couple of his ancestors, but of course it wasn't like that at all.
Wow. Yes. So you watched it as a child growing up. What was your first experience conducting it?
Well, as a matter of fact, this is my first experience conducting it. I've never conducted it before. It's a piece that actually a lot of the orchestra have not played it. But on the other hand, we have one cellist whose father was one of the original boy sopranos. So there is this sort of connection, familial connection. And the musicians, quite a few who haven't played it before, are terribly excited about playing this beautiful, gentle, expressive, and very poignant music.
That's awesome.
It's pretty neat, isn't it?
Well, you are filled with so much passion for the music and for education, and also you're known as having this wonderful sense of humor. And I've noticed a lot of smiles backstage when you're here. How does that affect your approach to music?
Well, I believe that music is a language, and I believe that it's a language that overcomes all hurdles between people. It's the only language that everybody on the planet understands. We can listen to and appreciate and understand something of the music of just about every culture on the globe by just sitting down in a chair and opening our ears and just listening. And I think music is something that transcends the incredible roadblocks we seem to put between ourselves sometimes. And the idea that we bring sounds alive that were heard 300-400 years ago, that to me is very stimulating, because these people who lived 300-400 years ago, people like Bach and Handel and Mozart, who lived just over 200 years ago, these people had something very relevant to say about the human condition, something that we still need to hear and understand. And for us to think that all decent human thought has taken place in the last 10 years is really not true at all.
Well, it's so great to have you back in Philadelphia.
It's very kind. Thank you. It's great to be back. I love coming here.
Well, thank you so much. We look forward to the second half. Bram Weltovi.
Thank you so much.